वासुदेवाया ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाया ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाया
Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Canto 5, Chapter 8, Text 21, translated by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. So we'll go directly to the translation. This is King Bharat speaking. He says, "Alas, the small deer, while playing with me and seeing me feigning meditation with closed eyes, would circumambulate me due to anger arising from love, and it would fearfully touch me with the points of its soft horns, which felt like drops of water." Purport. Now King Bharat considers his meditation false. While engaged in meditation, he was actually thinking of his deer, meaning like a fawn. And he would feel great pleasure when the animal pricked him with the points of its horns. Feigning meditation, the king would actually think of the animal, and this was but a sign of his downfall. Omagina timirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakmushtu unmalitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances at his lotus feet. Jai Shri Prabhupada. As we have heard from previous speakers, King Bharat, or Bharat Maharaj, is now in a very precarious, very dangerous position. And he is in this position. Well, let me explain. Why is he in a dangerous position? As it is mentioned in the last sentence that I spoke, he is falling down from his spiritual estate, his spiritual position. And he doesn't seem to know it. Or if he knows it, he doesn't seem to care, because he thinks that's the only thing or the best thing that he could do at this point in time. This is the nature of Maya, or the material energy, the illusory energy. She makes you think that what you're doing, even though it's wrong, even though it's harmful, even though it's devastating, it's right. It's right. It's perfect. It's good. Do it. Enjoy it. And then after you do it, you enjoy it, and you think it's right, you then get the fruit, which is bitter, which is painful, which is upsetting, which is disturbing. And in hindsight, we think, why did I do this? I was so foolish. Now I'm suffering so terribly. I made a terrible decision, a bad mistake, and now I'm suffering for it. Why did I do it? The scriptures say that I shouldn't have done it. I remembered that I shouldn't have done it, but what the heck, you know, just one time, is it going to hurt me? Isn't this the common statement of so many of us? Just one time. For example, some of us may have smoked cigarettes when we were younger and got the so-called pleasure of smoking. And then you say, well, what's one cigarette going to do? Or you took marijuana and you go somewhere down the block and you say, well, what's one hit going to do? Just a little bit of pleasure. I'm above all that. I'm transcendental. I'm detached. It can't affect me. It can't hurt me. I'm above it, beyond it. So what's one hit going to do? Nothing. And then 1 becomes 2, and 2 becomes 4, and 4 becomes 8, and 8 becomes 16, 24, 32, 48, 64. I can't count beyond that. So before you know it, the person is saying, what am I wasting my time in this temple setup? I could be out enjoying myself with my friends and doing this without any sense of guilt or shame. I could just go ahead and enjoy. So this is what happens. Maya comes to delude us. As Krishna says, all living beings are born into delusion, bewildered by dualities arisen from desire and hate. So, because Maya is always there to mislead us, to misguide us, and to remind us of how much pleasure there is in this material world and how happy you can be in this material world. There's nothing like it, nothing greater, nothing better. Just enjoy, just sop it up. And as we do that, for example, you take a gallon of ice cream, try to eat it, you'll have a big bellyache. Or you eat some food which you know is not right, you have a big bellyache. If not immediately, then tomorrow, the day after, or a few weeks later. But whenever we do something untoward, unfavorable, opposed to devotional principles, opposed to the laws of God, we have to suffer for that. It's natural. So here we have a very fascinating situation. And it's actually to instruct all of us. It's not happening to somebody thousands of years ago. It could be happening to any and each of us here. We should take it as our own story. For King Bharat was a person who was on a highly exalted position. It's not that he was some new brahmachari, or he was in the early stages of bhakti yoga. He had gone beyond. He was already on the eighth stage, known as bhava. He was on the ecstatic platform. He already had a taste. The dawning of pure love had already come to him. He was a few steps away from Krishna prema, and yet this little fawn was able to capture him and smash his spiritual life. Now, it is natural that as we grow in spiritual splendor, if you will, we also grow in compassion, we grow in understanding, we grow in love. So it was quite normal, quite natural for King Bharat, who was, of course, in a renounced position, when he saw this little fawn floating down the river, knowing it will die, there are so many rocks that it could crash into, or it will drown. It was normal and natural for him to save it. This is a devotee mentality. You don't want to see harm. You don't want to see pain. You want to relieve it. You want to help the person. So this is a charitable mentality. And as Krishna says, charity and austerity and sacrifices should never be given up, even in the higher stages of renunciation. But Bharat Maharaj, he went one step further. He rescued the deer. He helped to feed the deer. He helped to give it some feeling of security by petting it, hugging it. But then it triggered something. It revived something. And what did it revive? It revived a memory of when he was king and when he had his son, his child. And anyone who's had a son or a daughter or a child knows that there's great pleasure in the child's helplessness. The pleasure is in holding the child, coddling the child, feeling you are helping the child. You are assisting a person who is rather helpless and dependent. And it gives us a feeling of lordship, which is one of the reasons we come into this world, to lord it over, whether it's our children, whether it's our business, whether it's our subjects, if we're rulers. But we like to lord it over because lordship gives us a sense of importance, power, control. This is how we feel like God. It is mentioned that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, the supreme proprietor, and the supreme friend of all. And we, coming here to this world, try to duplicate or imitate that position. We try to enjoy through the tongue, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the ego, the intelligence. We try to own. We have one house, one car, one boat, one airplane. One child, then two children, three children, five kids. They're all mine. Just see my opulence. I own them all. I command them. I dictate them. I order them. And they just jump at my whim. This is a very heady feeling, very intoxicating. So Bharat Maharaj is triggering the remembrance of when he was a king and he had a child. And the little deer began to become symbolic of his child. He even called him his prince. He says, "Oh, my prince." Can you imagine the little deer calling it the prince? He had lost his marbles, as we say. How can a deer be a prince? He couldn't rule for a day. The only thing he could do is sit on the throne and pass stool. That would be his ultimate rulership. Couldn't do anything. And yet, here Bharat Maharaj is saying, "Oh, my little prince." He's cuddling it. He's hugging it. He's kissing it. He's rubbing noses with it. He's meditating with one eye open on the deer and the other eye, hopefully, on Krishna. But it's not doing very well on Krishna because the deer is his end-all and be-all at this moment. How nice it feels, the warmth of that little deer, when you cuddle it, when you pet it. You rub noses with it. It's so cute. It's so sweet. It's so lovable. It's so adorable. And it needs me. This is the illusion. It needs me. It can't get along without me. Unless I take care of it, it's going to die. Krishna? Krishna say? No, I'm going to save it. Actually, he should have simply taken the deer after 2 or 3 days and said, "Okay, time's up. You're going to your community now. Deer community. Let's go, buddy." And then taken it. The deer were all over the place. His mother was right by the waterside where Bharat was meditating. Take it into the deer community. And they'll take care. And if they don't take care, that's not your lookout. Your lookout is to look out for your spiritual life. You've done what you should. You saved it. You saved it from death. And Krishna allowed it to live. Will Krishna allow it to go on living? That's not in our hands to decide. Our hands is simply to take it to the deer community and let it live with its own. It may live, it may die. But what we must do is keep our spiritual life, or he should keep his spiritual life, alive. And the way he could keep it alive is by getting it out of his way, forgetting it, ignoring it. So he had forgotten the most basic devotional principle. And that principle is that we should not allow our minds to become attached to any person, any place, or anything. Because if we do, when we die, whoever at the end of his life quits his body remembering me alone, Krishna says, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. So, what is his state? When Bharat Maharaj is going to die, he's going to have the deer in his mind. Not just the deer, not just the picture, but emotional feelings coddling it, surrounding it, embracing it, attached feelings. And when there is attachment, that becomes the basis of one's next or future life. And one cannot do anything about it. Once you're in that position, once you're in that state, the laws of nature take over. Of course, Krishna was in charge. And Krishna would enable Bharat Maharaj, when he would die and then reincarnate as a deer, he would give him that knowledge of why he had fallen down, why he had come into this deer state, the state of an animal. And he not only that, he gave him remembrance of his past activities. And it enabled him to know his mistake so that he would never make that mistake again. And what did the deer do? Did he hang out with his own, with his, in his own community? Uh-uh. He wasn't going to get attached to any other deer, any female or any of that. He was going to hang out with the sages. So he was an anomaly deer. He was an abnormal deer. Most deers, they hang out with the deer. They don't go around the human beings. They're too frightened. So when the sages in that lofty place, they would have their little discourses, just like we're having today. They would talk about Krishna and the principles of devotional life and how to become attached to the Lord. The little deer would be sitting on its little legs and he would be listening and taking it in every moment of it, because he knew that when he dies again, he wants to be reborn in a family which would facilitate his becoming fully God realized. He missed it by a step, but now he wanted to be sure that he would never again fall into that most miserable situation. Now, look at Bharat Maharaj. As I said, he wanted the pleasure that comes from being a father. But look at all the miseries he was experiencing. He would sit down for meditation and he would wonder, where is my deer? He would open up his eyes. He couldn't find the deer. Is he wandering off? Maybe there's a wolf is attacking him. Maybe a tiger is going to get him. Maybe an elephant will step on him. Oh, I must find my deer. Forget about meditation now. I'm going to find the deer. And he would look here, look there, look everywhere until he found, ah, my son, my beloved, my dear, you're here. So then he felt some peace, supposed. This was his life. Anxiety, uncertainty, doubt, confusion, upset, disturbance. This is the price he paid for allowing himself to become attached to this deer, to see it as a lovable family member, to enjoy the pleasure of caring for a helpless creature. And forgetting that God ultimately is in charge of its life. This is where we forget that ultimately we can only make an effort, but the result of that effort will be given by the Lord himself according to our karma. So Bharat Maharaj made a very big mistake and he became increasingly attached to the deer. We can see other evidences in our scriptures of how attachment leads to such devastation. A very good example is perhaps Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra was the father of one of the princes, namely Duryodhana. Now, Dhritarashtra was the king, not because he had earned the right to be the king. Actually, Pandu was the king originally, but Pandu had killed a deer when it was in a state of intercourse, which was illegal, and was cursed. And after he was cursed, Pandu gave up the kingdom. He renounced it. And he offered it, gave it to his brother. He says, you take care of it. Brother was blind. Nonetheless, one wonders how he was the oldest. So by rights, he would normally, they call it primogeniture, by rights, he should have been the king. But no, because he was blind and he could not protect the kingdom, he could not guide the kingdom. He could not defend, as I said, the kingdom. He could not maintain it. But yet Pandu gave it to him. So how did he rule it? Under the guidance of Bhishma Dev. Bhishma Dev was qualified to rule a million kingdoms. He was so incredible. So Bhishma Dev, he guided him. And Vidura, he guided him. So between the two, who are most exalted personalities, both of them considered Mahajans, Dhritarashtra ruled. Now, when Duryodhana was born, he was the first of 100 sons that his mother, Gandhari, had given birth to. So because he was the first of 100 sons, Dhritarashtra immediately became very much attached to him. But Vidura, seeing the future and reading inauspicious and auspicious signs, when Duryodhana was born, there were jackals howling. There was lightning and thunder. There were all sorts of disturbing, inauspicious sounds occurring at that time. So Vidura understood that a very big-time demon has just been born. So he advised Dhritarashtra, he says, "My dear brother, you must sacrifice this one son. And the scriptures actually allow the sacrifice of a son if a whole kingdom can be saved from devastation." And that's exactly what Vidura was saying. It's not like Vidura was for human sacrifices. Far be it. He would be the least to do such a thing. But to save the entire dynasty, which he told Dhritarashtra, he says, "This child is going to be the bane of the existence of this dynasty. Millions of people are going to die because he's born with demoniac qualities. Please, let us sacrifice him." But what did Dhritarashtra say? No. He's my first, and immediately became attached to him and would not follow the guidance of his sage brother. Later on, when Duryodhana is grown up, Duryodhana had such sway, such power, such influence over his father, because his father was so attached. Why was his father attached to him? He maintained that hope that his son, even illegally, would become the next king. The next king should be Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira was entitled to it. He was the oldest son of Pandu. And actually, Dhritarashtra was what we call a pro tem king, pro tempore, meaning temporary until the oldest son of Pandu becomes of age and qualified to take up the reins of government. So he was still on the younger side. And even when he was qualified, Dhritarashtra would not yield his position. Why? In the hope that somehow the Pandavas would die and his own Duryodhana would become the king. Such is the menacing, horrible aspect of family attachment, that you're willing to give up all morality, all ethics, all righteousness, just so that your son can become the king. And through your son, you feel, "I am the Lord. I am above all. I am great. I am glorious. People honor me. They glorify me through my son." This is madness. And when Duryodhana suggested to his father, as a result of talking to his brothers, that they should build a house made of lac or combustible materials, send the Pandavas on a vacation, nice long one, send them away for 6 months, a year, and then we'll burn the house down along with their mother, and I'll be the king. And though Dhritarashtra knew, he knew the principles of righteousness, that this is wrong, this should never be done, still, he allowed himself to be swayed and hoodwinked, so to speak, and he approved it. Not only did he approve it, but he asked somebody in the assembly speak, when the Pandavas were in the assembly, about how wonderful it is in Varanavata. They have a festival going on there, and Lord Shiva is being worshipped there, and there's so many beautiful sights to see. So the whole idea was to stimulate the appetite of the Pandavas who had never been there. And they would then say, "Well, where is this place? It's only 50, 60 miles away. So go there and you can enjoy yourself." So the Pandavas actually said, "Yes, we'd love to go there." And then the house was built in a few weeks. And it was made of the materials that could, when you put a match to it, it would explode. It would go up in flames. So Dhritarashtra, as a result of attachment to his son, attachment to his position, and his desire to prolong or to extend that position to his son, was willing to murder his brother's wife and five children. Just see how attachment can warp, distort the mind, and cause it to make decisions which are completely reprehensible. And yet he thought it was okay. When you make every criminal, every mafioso, they all think what they're doing is right. And they will give you a full line of justifications, which sound very reasonable on the surface. But if you read Krishna's 16th chapter, you'll see how unreasonable it is. That this is demoniac, this is causes and creates bad society, and ultimately results in ruin and devastation. So here we see, we have some very wonderful examples, as I have already said. Dhritarashtra allowed this. But interestingly enough, and this is really what's really remarkable, in spite of these wonderful plans to set the house of Lak, or the house in Varanavata, on fire, they had a perfect plan. But Vidura, that they didn't count on Vidura, who had some special power. He could look at the face of a person and know it was in his mind. And as a result of that knowledge, he was able to communicate to the Pandavas exactly what was going on. In fact, before the Pandavas left for Varanavata, he told Yudhishthir in the language of the Nishida language, I believe, that he talked in a kind of a roundabout way. He said that when there is a fire, certain animals go underground to escape the fire. In effect, he was saying, there's a fire going to happen in your house, and you should make arrangements for a tunnel. This is what he was saying to him. So Vidura knew this because he could see all the plans just by looking at their face. He also knew when the fire would take place, which was about a year after, just by looking at their face. And he sent a messenger to the Pandavas, letting them know when the fire would take place. And the Pandavas knew when it would take place, and instead of being burned alive, what happened is that they were one step ahead of Purochana, who was supposed to light the fire, who was living there as a servant. And instead, they lit the fire, burned the house down, and Purochana got burned in it. And they were saved. That's a lengthy story. But suffice it to say that everyone thought that the Pandavas were dead because there was a banquet that night and there were six Nishidas who came in, and those mother and six children. Anyway, the Pandavas were saved. They were saved by the mercy of Krishna, who manifested through Vidura. You cannot kill someone who Krishna doesn't want to kill. You cannot save someone who Krishna wants to save. Krishna's in charge, and that's what the devotee takes shelter in, this very all-important fact that Krishna is in charge of my life. I can't do anything good. I can't do anything valuable. I can't do anything merciful unless Krishna enables me, allows me, helps me to do it. And as soon as we do something great or wonderful or famous or imaginative and we take the credit for it, we're in trouble because this is a misunderstanding of how the result occurred. Krishna says you have the right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your action. Who's the cause? I'm the cause, Krishna says. And if you know that I'm the cause, then all you must do is your duty, and do it as well as you can. And Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, whatever austerities you perform, you do them for me. He says to Arjuna on the chariot, therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, and at the same time perform your prescribed duty of fighting with your activities dedicated to me and your mind and intelligence fixed on me. You will come to me without a doubt. Don't even doubt it. Don't even think otherwise. All you have to do is keep me in your mind. But don't just keep me in your mind. Love me, he says. Serve me. Take shelter in me. Know that I alone am your benefactor. No one else. Sometimes people do things for us. It doesn't mean, well, it's really coming from Krishna, so I'm going to snub this person. I'm not going to say thank you. Why should I say thank you? You didn't do it. Krishna did it. This is foolishness. We live in a human society, and there are certain etiquettes. There are certain exchanges. And for the human society to go on, it's actually very, very what we call nice etiquette to appreciate what somebody else does for us. Because while, yes, that somebody else is doing it and is coming ultimately through Krishna, still that person agreed to be the instrument. And he gets credit for that, for being the instrument. We're all instruments of Krishna's love. So we should not be so cool or cold that we cannot thank somebody for doing something very wonderful. And if you don't thank somebody, then a situation may arise where we are not thanked. And if we want to be thanked, then we will feel upset and disturbed. And we shouldn't want to feel. Our only desire should be that, let me just serve you, Lord. Let me surrender to you more and more. Let me love you more and more. Let me remember you while I'm serving you. So if I can do this, then you will manifest through me. And what will come out of me will be something beautiful. Because you, Krishna, are the source of all beauty. You are the source of the personification of beauty. There can be no beauty in this world without your touch. We look at the beautiful trees, Krishna. The sun, Krishna. The moon, Krishna. The stars, Krishna. Human beings, Krishna. So much beauty everywhere and anywhere. All Krishna's mercy. And if we lose sight of that all-important fact, and we become in love with the form, remember, all forms disappear. Beautiful forms, like that little deer we're talking about. That deer is here today, gone tomorrow. The child that you love today will become an adult tomorrow. And after being an adult, he will be an old man. And after an old man or old woman, he will die. And there will be no form. So who should we love? The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, sees with equal vision. A learned and gentle Brahmin, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. We must love the Lord in everything, every person, every being. We must remember that Krishna is in the walls. Krishna is in the microphone. Krishna is in the devotee. Krishna is in the non-devotee. Krishna is everywhere. And as we remember Krishna everywhere, we get his blessings. We get his grace. It flows to us. If we forget Krishna, we get the grace of Maya. Do we want that? I don't think so. When you get the grace of Maya, you think, oh, what a wonderful world. It's so much enjoyment. Look at my wonderful property. Look at my great car. Look at all the adoration, profit, and distinction. I'm so important. I'm so famous. I'm so... Pop, you're dead. Where is it? Where did it go? Talk, talk, talk. Yuck, 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 yuck. Big bubble. Amounting to nothing. But the reality is that there is a person blowing the bubbles. And that person is Krishna. And we should not see just the bubbles, but we should see the divine being with his pipe blowing out all these wonderful souls and all these wonderful creations, and see them, adore them, admire them. Love your child. Does it mean you should ignore your child, detach yourself from your child, forget your child? No. Love your child for the sake of Krishna. Krishna is in your child. Krishna is in your wife. Krishna is in your husband. Krishna is in your granddaddy. Krishna is in the paintings, in the walls. Love all of them for the sake of Krishna, because Krishna is in them and he's manifesting through them. And to the degree that we are advanced, to the degree that we are full of love for Krishna, to that degree we will sense him, we will feel his presence. And ultimately, as our wonderful Srila Prabhupada has so often said, you will see Krishna. We will see him when we love him fully and truly and completely. When our surrender, as Krishna says, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. When our surrender is complete and total and full, and when we actually think we are not at all surrendered, I'm so proud, I'm so wonderful, I have no good qualification. When we're thinking so in such a humble fashion, Krishna is ready there to appear before us. It is this weed of pride that Krishna does not want us to have. So if we develop the requisite humility, which means that I'm lower than the straw on the street, I'm unworthy of seeing Krishna, I'm unworthy of even getting the opportunity to worship Krishna, but Krishna is giving me this incredible opportunity to do this. So let me take it seriously. Let me take it as a valuable gift. A miser holds a diamond in his hand so tight, he practically draws liquid out of it. Let us hold Krishna in our hearts so tightly that Krishna will feel the intensity of our love so that he will never want to not think of us, not grace us, not bless us. The pure devotee is always in the core of my heart, and I am always within the heart of the pure devotee. The devotee does not know anything else but me, and I do not know anything else but him. This is the high, sublime, exalted state to which we all must aspire. We all have a great, glorious, wonderful opportunity. Every moment is ticking away. We can use it for good, as Bharat Maharaj originally did, or we can use it for bad by forgetting all the teachings that we have received, ignoring them, neglecting them, and going off on a wrong path, which leads, as I've already given a few incidents, to terrible misery. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any comments or any questions that I can possibly try to answer? Yes, Prabhuji. Hare Bol.
Thank you for the nice class. There's a couple of things we were discussing yesterday with regards to some of the points you made today about moral dilemmas that sometimes face us.
What?
Moral dilemmas that sometimes face us. And this topic of the Pandavas and how they treated those Nishadas at Varanavat, the topic of how the Pandavas treated the Nishadas at Varanavat when that house was burnt down came up, that how would one justify basically murdering those five innocent people in order to gain the kingdom in the Pandavas' minds? How would they justify that?
Well, I'd have to be Dhritarashtra. I'm not. But, I mean, I could take a stab at it. Because to do that, you actually have to be fraught with quite a bit of evil. And once you're into that evil mentality, then you can figure out reasons. Like I said, the mafioso, they go around killing people like it's nothing. And they have a lot of good reasons that what they will give you. In terms of Dhritarashtra, if I were him, now I'm just playing, I'm playing Fantasy Island at this moment. And I had to have a reason, to kill the five Pandavas. Is that actually, he wouldn't have a justification. There really isn't. I don't think Dhritarashtra, he has enough good training to know it's wrong. You see. But, as we mentioned a little earlier, in spite of the fact that he knew it was wrong, his attachment to Duryodhana and his attachment or his desire for Duryodhana to be the king far outweighed his concern for morality, ethics, righteousness. I think Dhritarashtra fully, not I think, I know, he fully knew it was wrong. And he admitted this much later on in Bhagavatam. We see that. So, but he's thinking, if they're dead, they're dead, and everybody thinks it's an accident, so. And my son gets to be the king. Remember, he's a blind king. He was born with a deformity. His only great strength was his strength. He was very powerful. He had arms that could crush a person very easily. Probably was a power builder, So he almost crushed Bhima to death, but Krishna saved Bhima by putting a metal statue, so that when Dhritarashtra went to hug him, he hugged the metal statue and literally crushed the statue. And Bhima, of course, had been warned by Krishna, don't let him hug you, it's over. So there is no real justification except that when you love somebody and you want that somebody as an extension of your own ego to succeed, then emotion rules, and that's all. There is no justification, except that how wonderful it would be if I could become the king. He never could become the real king, because he was blind. He was basically an interim king. But Duryodhana could have been a real king, and that's what he really wanted. So that's his own. That's my only. If anyone has any other reason they'd like to venture, please feel free to do that. Yes, Prabhu. He'll bring you the microphone. Yeah, he'll bring it. But talk loud because I'm getting old.
besides that,
okay, thank you.
Besides that, he was nursing an ambition to become king. It was the company.
You have to come closer. I'm not hearing. Come.
It was the company that makes the man different. Because, with his ambitions, he has been nursing all along to become king. It was Shakuni who all along been inspiring him that why should he not be king or why should his son not be king. So, the question of company also comes. Krishna was good Pandavas were good because they were in the company of Krishna. Duryodhana was bad because he was in the company of Shakuni. So it comes the question of the company also. Thank you.
Yes, but company is a choice. You choose your company. He chose you talk, now I talk. He chose his company. And why did he choose Shakuni? Because he himself was evil. Vidura mentioned that. Evil attracts evil. Shakuni was wily, he was crafty, he was he was the kind of person, underhanded person, not straightforward, not upfront, as we would say. So, yes, that was their choice. You get the fruit of your choices. Other question? No one else? Oh, you have a question. Bring the mic to him. We have one more. Please. Okay, thank you. Go. Yeah, but they on the internet, they want to hear you. You're going to be heard in India right now.
All right, sounds good. I was just wondering, I liked the example you gave about how, you know, Krishna or Vishnu blows out all the bubbles and each, you know, bubble's like a universe and it comes out of all of his pores. I just wanted to know, like, could you go over the three original Vishnus again?
Could I what?
The three original Vishnus, like how the cosmic manifestations created, like there's a Garbhodakshi Vishnu, there's a...
Well, I would be happy to do that, but we're way over time right now.
All right, no problem.
But there's plenty of that in our books.
Okay.
Basically, I'll just say just a few words. Just you said it.
Mahavishnu
becomes Garbhodakshi Vishnu, head of all the universes, who then becomes Kshiradakshayi Vishnu, who resides on Shveta Dvip, and who becomes the various incarnations on this earth. And they're all equal in power, and... ultimately, they're under Krishna's thumb. That's it. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Thanks for sitting it out.
Thank you so much for a wonderful class. This whole section of the Bhagavatam reminds us we have to be ever vigilant.
There you go.
Ever vigilant.
I'm sorry I didn't use that word. That was...